Nothing is so difficult as not deceiving oneself. A quote from Ludwig Wittgenstein. Thought is always saying that thought didn't do it. A quote by David Bohm. Let's continue with our series on self-deception. This is part two. Make sure that you watched part one, which gives context to part two. And what I'm going to be talking about in this section is over 60 different self-deception mechanisms, which I've identified and categorized and studied. And I'll be presenting those to you and talking about them in some length. There's a lot of material. But before we get into that, we need to do a quick recap of part one. So what did we learn in part one? We basically learned that the mind is a self-deception engine. And why would it be that? Because without illusion, nothing can exist. Reality must be dreamed into being. And that's done with your mind. And this dream needs to be sustained. And this dream is sustained through self-deception. Your mind's job is to construct reality, to create this dream so that you can be alive and partake in all the features of life. And it is not in your mind's interest to look inside at the machinery which is constructing the dream, because that actually punctures the illusion of reality. So how is this dream maintained? It's maintained through a lack of self-awareness, through a lack of self-reflection. Your mind keeps your attention riveted outwards, externally, on all the stuff within the dreamscape, so that you don't turn inwards and really question deeply what's going on behind the scenes, because that would rupture the illusion. And in a sense, you want to be in the spell inside the dream. Unless maybe you get the bright idea that you want to jailbreak your mind and see what reality is like outside of the dream. That's it in a nutshell. This entire topic I call epistemology, and it's really part of a book that I'm working on, which is going to be all about the deceptive nature of the mind. I've been working on it for over a year, and really I've been collecting this material and thinking about self-deception for at least 10 years. I've assembled thousands of pages of notes and quotes and my own analysis and examples that I find throughout culture and in myself and other people and throughout literature and throughout science and religion and history and everywhere. And I have hundreds of audios that I recorded personally just for myself, my own notes and thinking about this topic. It's a very deep topic. This is like my life's work here. And what you're getting here with this two-part series is you're getting just like 1% of the research that I've done into this topic of self-deception and the trickery of the mind. So this is some very, very complicated and nuanced stuff, which is why I love to research it, because it does require a lot of nuance, and that's something that my mind loves. Speaking of which, let's consider deception not just within humans, but also within nature at large. I like to always put everything into like a bigger context. So notice that nature and the animal kingdom actually loves to employ deception for the purposes of survival. A lot of animals that you see on the Discovery Channel, you see their amazing camouflage, how remarkable it is and how helpful that is for them surviving. Their life depends on excellent camouflage. Some animals even have active camouflage, like mimic octopuses and certain flounder fish and chameleons, although chameleons use their pigments actually for communications more so than for hiding from predators. But you can see that in nature, there are many examples, very remarkable examples of deception at work. And one that I love perhaps the most is the cuckoo bird. This is one of nature's most devilish examples of deception. What the cuckoo bird will do is it will find a nest of some other bird, some smaller bird, because the cuckoo bird's pretty big, So it finds some kind of small nest, like sparrows or whatever, and it'll fly in there, and it'll actually kick out one of the eggs in the nest while the adult birds are gone. It kicks out one of the eggs. It sticks its own larger cuckoo egg in there, and the cuckoo egg is perfectly camouflaged so that it looks exactly like the other eggs, even though it is bigger in size. And then it flies away. And then that cuckoo egg will hatch. It'll hatch sooner than all the other eggs, by design, of course. And this cuckoo bird, this little baby cuckoo chick, is born with certain features. Like it has little hooks on the tip of its beak. And also it has the ability to kick out the other eggs from the nest. So you can see pictures of these cuckoo chicks who don't even have feathers yet. They're completely naked. They can't even see. And yet they have a mechanism hardwired into their psychology that forces them to kick out all the other eggs in the nest so that it's the only one remaining. And the adult sparrows, for example, they are tricked into feeding this cuckoo chick because it tricks their mind into being so deceived that they actually think that, oh, I'm now bonded with this chick and this chick must be my child. And so, of course, they're not going to kick it out of the nest, even though it's actually going to destroy all the other legitimate sparrow chicks. And so these sparrows will actually feed this cuckoo bird, this large giant cuckoo bird, which looks nothing like them, but it's this, see, the cuckoo is exploiting this sort of glitch in the sparrow's psyche because of the sort of bonding that happens between adult and child, such that they just keep feeding and feeding the cuckoo bird until the cuckoo bird becomes fully mature and then flies away to repeat this whole thing over again. And you can actually see pictures of this gigantic, oversized cuckoo bird, which is almost bigger than the entire nest. And it's the only one that's in there. All the other chicks have been thrown out. And it's being fed by these little adult sparrow birds or some other kinds of birds. It's an amazing and remarkable deception that nature has thought up. And why did nature think this up? Well, of course, for the purposes of self-survival. And now you might think, oh, this cuckoo bird is such an evil creature for doing this. But look at the situation a little bit more objectively. What is the cuckoo bird doing? It's just trying to survive. This is how it survives. And you might say, oh, but why does it do it in such an evil and selfish manner? And that's precisely right. Because see, in this example, what you're being shown is the sort of stark brutality of selfishness. It doesn't care. It doesn't care about the other baby birds. It doesn't care about the adults. It doesn't care about whether it tricks someone or doesn't. It doesn't care. As long as it works, that's all it cares about. And in this example, even though the cuckoo bird might seem very evil for doing what it does, but really it's doing nothing different than what you're doing, what all of us are doing. To be alive is to be evil, is to be selfish. It's just that with this example of the cuckoo bird, it's easy to see because we're seeing it out there in somebody else. But when these cuckoo mechanisms are pointed out within you, that's something your mind does not want you to see. Because you see, what happened in nature, very interestingly, is that there's a lot of deception, just regular old deception going on in nature. But usually that deception is oriented towards tricking other animals. But nature with humans, because we have these advanced minds which are able to conceptualize, has gone one step further and has allowed us to turn this deception mechanism inside towards ourselves from the outside in, such that now we are deceiving ourselves more than we're deceiving people out there. Although, of course, we still deceive plenty of people out there. But you see, to deceive other people out there, can you see how it's really helpful to be able to deceive yourself first? Because once you've deceived yourself, that means you can be extremely selfish in deceiving everybody else. And that lets you get away with a lot of stuff that you normally wouldn't be able to get away with. For example, this cuckoo bird, do you think this cuckoo bird would be able to survive if it had a sense of morality? And if it had this sense of like, oh, well, but I'm being so evil by kicking these other baby birds out of the nest. No, it doesn't have that sense, precisely because it's not in its interest to have that sort of sense. But human beings, see, we are social creatures. We live in large groups, so we need a sense of morality, otherwise our large groups will start to break apart. But nevertheless, we don't want to be too honest with each other and with ourselves. We want to still be able to deceive. So human beings are some of the most deceptive creatures that exist for this very reason, because we need to be deceiving while at the same time putting on the airs as if nothing's going on. And what better way to do that than to deceive yourself in the process? Think of how much more you'll be able to get away with. Think of how sneaky you can be when you don't even know that you're being sneaky. That's what's happened. And it's really a work of genius. It's genius. It's pure genius. It's amazing. This is not something to get depressed about. This is something to marvel at. It's really mind-blowing stuff. The basic form that all self-deception takes is as follows. You think you know things which you really do not know. Every time that you take a firm position on anything, you open yourself up to self-deception. So if you take a firm position on God, you're opening yourself up to self-deception. If you take a firm position on science, or on some political ideology, or about some government policy, or about some sort of moralistic cause or principle or value. So you're taking a firm position, you're believing in it, and then you're kind of staking your life on that thing. And that's when you're prone to self-deception. Because if you didn't have any firm positions on anything, well, then you could just kind of be loosey-goosey. But see, having firm decisions or firm positions is actually very helpful for your ability to survive. And it also plays into your sense of identity. So it's really hard to go through life without taking firm positions. That's what most people do, and that's precisely when they fall into all these traps of self-deception. So we're going to be talking about a lot of them now. Here they are in no particular order. I specifically didn't like categorize them in any like order of most to least important, because this whole field is so complex. There just isn't a simple list of like, oh, here's number one, here's number two, here's number three. There's just a whole lot of them. And of course, different people will succumb to different self-deception mechanisms depending on their situations, the time that they're living in, the country they're living in, and other factors like that. But let's begin with these very basic ones, which are common to almost everybody. Number one, thinking that you've basically got reality figured out. Because, hey, if you got reality figured out, then why read books? Why listen to teachers? Why look at diverse perspectives? Why go out of your way to try psychedelics? Why go out of your way to travel to different countries? Why go out of your way to listen to diverse opinions? There is no reason, because, hey, you've basically got reality figured out. And that's a huge self-deception. That one right there basically cripples your ability to learn new things, which is a big problem, because then you get stuck with just being who you are, and that's it, with no opportunity for growth. Number two is believing that reality is just an objective thing, and that the mind plays little role in this objective reality, and that basically facts about the world exist independent of interpretation. Such that, yeah, you admit that there are certain opinions that people can have and certain interpretations, but then in the back of your mind, you really hold that there just are certain things which are just objective brute facts, and you would have to be crazy or insane or mentally handicapped to not accept some of these given facts. But you see, when your mind gets you to buy this line of reasoning, then that means that your mind can inject whatever kind of facts, objective facts it wants. It can stick anything under that category of objective facts, and then you're going to actually hold those as objective facts. You see how convenient that is for the mind? Because the mind can sneak in almost anything it wants there. It can sneak in God. It can sneak in aliens. It can sneak in conspiracy theories. It can sneak in any kind of materialistic theories about the world. Basically, anything you want can be snuck in there. So that's a really tricky one. The next deception mechanism is assuming that self-deception isn't a significant factor in your life. It's like, yeah, Leo, sure, self-deception happens, and mostly it happens with other people, and even if it happens in me, it happens like maybe 10% of the time, or like maybe 20% of the time, maybe 30% of the time it happens. But that's about it. It's not very significant. Do we really need to spend all this time talking about it? It's that kind of thinking. That's the self-deception. Underestimating self-deception. Thinking that self-deception is easy to spot and to uncover. Of course, that makes self-deception really difficult to spot and uncover when you assume it's easy, when you assume it's insignificant, because then it can be very significant in actual fact. But you won't know that because you're assuming it's not very significant. The next mechanism is thinking that you can avoid metaphysics. Some people, especially a lot of scientific people, they poo-poo metaphysics. And they say, oh, metaphysics, that's for the philosophers. That's something science used to do 500 years ago. But we've grown up now. We don't do any metaphysics. We're metaphysics free. There is no such thing, though, as metaphysics free. There is either you're aware and you're constantly thinking about your metaphysical assumptions and your metaphysical, certain metaphysical facets of your worldview, or you're not thinking about them. But it's not that you don't have them. Just because you're not investigating metaphysics or thinking about metaphysics doesn't mean you don't have a latent de facto metaphysics. Everyone who thinks that they can just avoid metaphysics because it's just abstract, airy-fairy type of stuff that doesn't really concern real-world life, they're very wrong, because what happens with them is they just end up picking up the de facto metaphysics of their culture, of their peer group, of their family, of their religion, or of their science. And if you're a scientifically minded person, if you're a scientist and academic, really watch out for this one, because I see a lot of very intelligent, academically minded people who trick themselves with this, thinking that they're not engaging in metaphysics because they're a part of the scientific method, and that the scientific method is metaphysics free. This is preposterous. Not at all. There are many, many assumptions that the scientific method makes, many of them completely groundless and factually false. And yet they are made nonetheless, and what makes them even more deceptive is that these people are not aware that they are holding these metaphysical assumptions. The next self-deception mechanism is conceptualization. This is huge. This is a very broad category. And I've spoken about this in the past, and I will in the future. But it's basically the mistake of confusing the map for the territory. And that seems like a very simple mistake, and it is a very simple mistake. It's a very obvious mistake. And when most people are told that, hey, you're confusing the map for the territory, they will say, oh, yeah, of course, yeah, I know the map is not the territory. That's obvious. Duh, Leo, that's obvious. So what? But see, it's one thing to hear the phrase, the map is not the territory. It's another thing to actually understand that this applies to a lot of stuff you hold in your life. You hold the map as the territory. And again, a lot of scientifically minded people make this mistake because science does a lot of mapping and a lot of modeling. But then because science is always modeling, it's conceptualizing reality so much all the time that it forgets that it's conceptualizing and modeling reality. And it forgets that there's the model and there's a territory. And these are two very different things. And in many ways, the better your models become, the more problematic this problem becomes, because the greater the gap that builds up between the map and the territory. And then your very juicy and successful models are very easy to mistake for the territory. And what a lot of scientists and academics do is they just forget about the territory entirely. They get completely wrapped up in their maps. And that happens because of a lack of mindfulness over the entire thinking process. In general, people are very poor in our culture and society these days at distinguishing between a concept and direct experiences. Because this takes practice, a lot of mindfulness practice, a lot of meditation work. Hundreds and thousands of hours of mindfulness practice is required to be able to separate out your thoughts from your sensory perceptions, and so that those things are not constantly being fused in your mind, which is the problem that most people face, most academic and intellectually minded people face this problem. And it's a really big problem. And this is why I say that for scientists and academics, one of the most important things you should be doing if you really care about your career and you really care about discovering the truth with your scientific discoveries is you need to be meditating every single day, like your life depended on it, like your entire career depended on it, because it does. Because if you don't do this, if you don't develop this mindfulness practice every single day, then you're guaranteed to get lost in your conceptualizations and in your maps and in your models. Guaranteed. There's no way you're going to avoid it. It's just way too tricky of a thing. That's why this is a really important habit. But of course, not just for scientists or mathematicians or logicians, but really for everybody. But for those of you who are in these kind of hardcore scientific fields, if you're a physicist, if you're a cosmologist, if you're a molecular biologist, if you're a computer scientist, you have to be developing mindfulness over your thoughts, because otherwise you're going to get completely lost and self-deceived with your conceptualizations. Precisely because you're the type of person who has the personality and mind type which loves to conceptualize, which is why you went into those fields in the first place. And you spent so many years in school and in university and getting your PhD and all of that. The next self-deception mechanism is language and labeling. This one is huge, and I'll shoot specific episodes about language in the future, and I already have in the past. But see, the problem with language is that it also is a sort of a component of this conceptualizing problem. And we think that when we attach labels to objects in the world, that we actually know more about those objects than we really do. And if you notice, scientists, for example, and academics, they love to use big flowery words and complicated language. And they write these papers and they write these books, which are filled with a lot of technical jargon. And this language becomes very tricky. It's very easy to deceive yourself with it and with all the labels, because it's not that you're just attaching a label to something. The label also carries with it an infinite number of connections and ancillary meanings, implicit meanings of other concepts that this label is attached to. So your mind isn't just attaching labels to things, it's forming these networks in your minds of meaning. And then this can create all sorts of labyrinths in your mind that are very difficult to escape. The next self-deception mechanism is a very broad one: belief and hearsay. So many people do not understand the distinction between a belief and direct experience of a thing, because this is not taught in schools at all. We're not taught to make this distinction. Even in science, you might think, oh, well, but in science, everything is based on empirical evidence. No, it's not. Most of science is built upon concepts and models and beliefs. Science is a highly belief-based system. This is a mistake that very many rational people make, is they think that science is immune to this problem of beliefs, making it different from religion. No, science is just as much belief-based as religion is. Because in science, you have to believe a lot of stuff. Most of the stuff you learned in high school and in college about science, about physics, about biology, about chemistry, is completely belief-based. You didn't derive any of it for yourself. You just accepted it as blind facts. And what's worse is that, not only that, but you also accepted the meta-belief that science is not belief-based, and that these things are not beliefs, that gravity is not a belief, that the Earth being round is not a belief, that the Big Bang is not a belief, that these things are truth, when in fact you have to be conscious that actually these are beliefs. And how did you get these beliefs? Did you get them through personally deriving them, through actually going and looking through a telescope to seeing if there's actually a Mars out there, if there's a Venus out there, if there's a Saturn or a Jupiter out there with so many moons circling around it? Did you actually go and do that through a telescope? Chances are you probably didn't. And yet you believe in these planets. But what are these planets? For most people, for 99% of people, these planets are purely beliefs. Hearsay. Information that you got secondhand from other people. Sure, you got them from respected academics and from textbooks that have been written by PhDs and from Nobel Prize winners and from the Discovery Science Channel and this sort of stuff. You got them from quote-unquote reputable sources, you think, but that doesn't change the fact that it's just hearsay. And this blurs the line between belief and direct experience. And the problem with that is that then you become very self-deceived, because when I start talking to you about, for example, contemplation or meditation or self-inquiry, deriving some fundamental truths about your own existence for yourself, people say, ah, Leo, but where's the proof for that? Where's the evidence? And that just tells me right there that they're not conscious of what evidence is. Evidence is exactly what I'm pointing you to. Meditation is the evidence you're looking for when you're talking about things within your own psyche, for example. That is direct experience. You can't get more direct than your present experience. The only way you can make that mistake is by being so lost in beliefs that you don't even differentiate anymore between what is a belief versus what is a direct experience. Because in point of fact, and this is one of the shocking things you can reveal to yourself, is that 99% of everything you hold to be true is purely secondhand information passed down to you as beliefs, and you just believe in it. And you believe in it mostly not because you have direct evidence of it. You don't have any direct evidence of Jupiter. You've never seen any direct evidence of Jupiter. What you've got is you've got a sort of a cohesive story, a web of belief that you've built. Belief propping up another belief, propping up another belief, propping up another belief. And then based on this, you get a sort of a sense of cohesion. And then you say, oh, well, yeah, it sort of makes sense. Everything sort of fits together in my little worldview. But then what you don't understand is that there are many worldviews that can have cohesion, but that doesn't make them true. It's possible to create an infinite number of self-consistent, self-cohesive worldviews. It doesn't mean that they're right. And that's another self-deception mechanism right there, is judging the correctness of your worldview based on how cohesive it feels. That's a false metric. You can't do that. If you do that, then riddle me this. How will you distinguish one cohesive worldview from another? You see, that's the problem there. If you have five different self-consistent, cohesive worldviews, which one of those are you going to choose? How are you going to arbitrate between all of them? You won't be able to, is the point. In fact, you'll just pick the one that you grew up in, the one that's closest to your personal preferences, and you'll just believe that one. And of course, that's completely arbitrary, but it won't feel that way to you. It'll feel completely cohesive, and that will be this sort of false sense of reality which your mind has created. See, what reality really boils down to is just a sense of reality, a sense of consistency, a sense of solidity. These are appearances. These aren't facts, these are appearances. And of course, appearances can be deceiving. Another mechanism is the unwillingness to admit, I don't know. The human mind loves certainty and it hates uncertainty. And unless your mind is trained otherwise, it will always try to claim that it knows more than it really does. We hate to admit that we don't really know, when in fact we don't really know. So if I ask you, where did the universe come from? Are you going to say, I don't know? Probably not. You're going to have some kind of story. It came from the Big Bang, or Stephen Hawking says this, or this guy says that, or I have this idea. But you're not going to admit that you really don't know. Or if I ask you, well, where did the dinosaurs come from? You'll say, oh, I know that one. If they came from evolution, we can explain it all away. But do you really know? And how did they die out? Oh, we can explain that one too. It's, you know, a big meteorite came and it hits the earth and all the big dinosaurs died. You think that. You believe that. You've been told that. It feels like that fits everything else you've been told. But in point of fact, you don't actually know these things. There's a lot that you don't know. And you have to retrain yourself to start to admit that if you want to make progress epistemically. And notice that people hate admitting that they don't know. Because as an entire culture, we're conditioned to think that if we admit that we don't know, that means we're deficient, we're stupid, or there's something wrong with us. Another self-deception mechanism is childhood imprinting and indoctrination. This is a huge one, which bears a lot of conversation and a lot of explanation. I'll just cover it lightly here. I'll shoot up probably an episode on it in the future. But have you noticed that children get easily indoctrinated? Literally, the mind can get imprinted with ideas. If you take a young child and you raise this child in a racist family, that child has a almost 100% chance of growing up being a racist. Why is that? Is that an accident? No, because the mind gets programmed, imprinted. The mind will believe whatever its environment leads it to believe. Whatever the adults in the environment are talking about and saying, generally speaking, the child's mind will just pick that up, adopt all those beliefs, all those core assumptions. And especially what the mind will pick up is any kind of religious beliefs or assumptions or metaphysical beliefs or assumptions. So a child growing up in an atheist household is very likely to turn out to be an atheist. And a child growing up in a religious household is very likely to hold the exact same religious views. You're not going to get a Jewish child born in a Muslim family. This is not going to happen. And vice versa, it's not going to happen either. Why is that? Because of this imprinting factor. And this imprinting factor is so huge and significant that it's almost impossible to articulate how significant it is. You think that I'm just talking about like other groups of people who get imprinted with ideas. No, I'm talking about you. I'm talking about you and your family. You have been imprinted. I'm not talking about some bad family that abuses their children. No, I'm talking about you. Every single family imprints their child with all sorts of assumptions about reality. And those assumptions are extremely difficult to break, because the way the mind works is that it's sort of like a blank slate when it starts. It can get programmed with anything. And so what it does is it just accepts whatever worldviews are given to it. It's like the first stuff that you write on a piece of paper. You know, if you write something on a piece of paper, it's completely blank. You write something on it. It's very easy the first time because the paper was blank. Now, if you go back to it again, you filled your whole page, you want to write on some more. Well, now you got a problem because you got to write over stuff that's already there. And you've been writing in permanent ink in a Sharpie. It's really difficult to erase that stuff. So literally what happens with most human beings is that they get imprinted for the first 18 to 20 years of their life, from birth to 20, let's say. They get imprinted with all this stuff. Their little piece of paper gets completely filled up. And then when they get to me and I have to talk to them, like I'm talking to you now, about a lot of these concepts, what do you think happens? It's impossible to get any of these concepts to stick, because anything that doesn't agree with what's already written on that paper is not going to get accepted. But you know, the real trick is that the stuff that got written on the paper in the first place, it got written there without any kind of evidence or justification. You see, people don't get this about the mind. The mind isn't using any strong filters or logic to filter out what's written on the paper the first time around. All the stuff written on the paper the first time around is just anything that you want. If you want, you can take a child and you could teach him to become a racist. You could teach him to become a murderer. You can teach him to become an atheist. You can teach him to become a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim, a radical, a terrorist, you know, a Nazi, whatever you want. All of it is completely open. And the child, whatever you imprint him with, he's going to actually believe that as if it's reality. And he's not going to know any different because a child doesn't know any better. There's no filters. This is such a strong mechanism that societies and religions and even science has exploited this for millennia. There's always a battle going on within society about what are we going to imprint the children with? And that's a huge political battle. Because another self-deception mechanism here, which is related to this one, is what I call this the need for contrast in order for the human mind to grasp something. See, the human mind cannot grasp something unless it has something else to contrast it against. So, for example, if you're born into poverty, that's just like what your mind is going to take as reality. Your reality is going to be a poor, impoverished reality. And if you're born into richness and wealth and luxury, your mind is going to accept that, and it's not going to know any different. You see, and if you're born into a society where there's no racism around you, like maybe you're in a good neighborhood where there's no racism going on, then because of a lack of contrast, you're going to grow up believing that there's no racism in the world. Whereas if you grow up in the ghetto somewhere where there is a lot of racism, then your mind is going to believe that there's a lot of racism in the world. You see, because you need the contrast. And a lot of the way that humans learn is through contrast. So maybe you've been living in a little bubble in your own little country for a long time, and then you decide to go traveling to some other radically different country with a different culture. And you get this culture shock of like, oh my God, these people like eat with their hands, and they wipe their ass with their hands, and then like they use chopsticks, or they speak this thing, or they have these kinds of manners or this kind of etiquette. Like these people here bow to you. Those people eat their food sloppily and make all sorts of noises when they're eating, you know, all these different things. They're all contrasting with what you know from your own culture. And that contrast is what kind of shocks you and wakes you up. It's the same problem as, you know, a fish not knowing that it's in water because there's a lack of contrast. You take oxygen for granted. Why is that? Because most of the time you have plenty of oxygen. It's very rarely when you're running out of oxygen, like when you're locked into a small closet and you have no way to get out, that all of a sudden you start worrying about oxygen and you don't take it for granted anymore, because the mind requires contrast to be conscious of things. And this is a very effective way that your own mind can deceive you, because all it has to do is remove the contrast, and then you won't even know that that thing is there. For example, if you don't have any contrast to reality, then whatever you're experiencing seems like reality. Another mechanism is assumptions. This is a huge, very general category, and there's thousands of assumptions that we make that are false and self-deceptive. But the general mechanism of assumptions is the following, is that we make assumptions, but we're not conscious of the fact that we've made these assumptions. So they turn into subconscious or implicit or latent assumptions, which are just taken for granted, taken as reality. And based on this, a ton of self-deception gets created. Specifically, I'll point out a couple of really big assumptions that are made that are very self-deceptive. The entire materialist paradigm is an assumption that a lot of people in our society hold, a lot of scientifically minded people hold. The scientific method is also an assumption. People take the scientific method completely for granted. They don't think about what it is or why it works or what its limitations are. They just tend to assume that, oh, scientific method just is the way that we arrive at truth, without ever investigating that any deeper. And there's a ton of metaphysical and epistemic assumptions that every human being holds. And what's really scary is that they don't even know, most people don't even know, what the word metaphysical or epistemic means. So when these words are brought up, they say, oh, Leo, I don't have any metaphysical or epistemic assumptions. I don't even know what those words mean. That does not excuse you from having those assumptions, though. See, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I could talk about assumptions for hours. There's so many assumptions that people make that deceive them. The next mechanism is self-evidence or a priori truths. In Western philosophy, if you've studied it at all, then you've heard this word a priori. This is a really toxic concept, which has led to so much self-deception within Western intellectual tradition. But even if you haven't heard the word, nevertheless, it's still a problem. What this means is that it just basically means that there are certain truths that can be known because they're so obvious and so self-evident that they need no empirical investigation. You might say that 1 + 1 = 2 is an a priori truth because it doesn't even depend on your ability to experience or your ability to run a scientific experiment. This is sort of like a logical truth of the mind. Of course, this is complete bullshit. There are no such thing as a priori truths. Nothing is known a priori. A priori, you are completely clueless. But the mind loves to attach this label a priori or self-evident to things that it learns later on through experience, of course. It likes to trick itself by saying, oh, well, that could have been a priori. This could have been a priori, because that makes it feel more real. See, when you say something is self-evident, that sort of means that it couldn't be any other way and that it's actually obvious, when in fact, in truth, nothing is obvious. Even 1 + 1 = 2, you might think, oh, that's Leo, that's so obvious. That's not obvious at all. If you're very honest and you look back at your life, you actually had to work really hard as a child to learn that 1 + 1 = 2 and 2 × 2 = 4 and so on and so forth. All that stuff had to be learned, and it was challenging to learn. And when you were learning it, it didn't make sense to you. So there was nothing obvious about it. When you say something is obvious, that actually makes you take it for granted more, which is a big problem. And this problem is rampant throughout all of science. Another self-deception mechanism is emotions. Emotions are extremely self-deceptive because what is an emotion trying to do? It's trying to, look, emote, motion. The word motion is in emotion. Emotions are about putting you into motion. And your body uses emotions to get you moving to save your ass. That's why when you stick your hand in a fire, you feel some emotion, some pain. It gets you to move your hand back. And you might say, well, that's kind of like a reflex, right? Maybe that is a reflex, but you've got all these other emotions. You've got all sorts of fear. You've got anger, you've got jealousy, you've got boredom, you've got excitement. All these emotions are moving you. They're manipulating you. Your mind's job is to use these emotions to manipulate you. Your mind doesn't manipulate you primarily through logic and reason, but through emotions, which are why emotions are some of the hardest things to master. You can become enlightened, but you ain't going to master your emotions for another 40 years. Mastering emotions is some of the trickiest stuff because emotions are very self-deceptive, and because they have a real punch behind them. You see, when you're afraid of something, so fear is an especially self-deceptive emotion. When you're afraid of something, then it's very easy for your mind to get you to avoid it. So you see, if your own mind wanted to really trick you, if there was some truth that your mind didn't want you to see, where would it hide that truth? Behind a wall of fear. Easiest thing in the world. Take your fear of death. You fear death so much that I could hide $100 billion behind your fear of death and you would never access that money because you would do anything to avoid dying. See? And your mind will tell you, oh, but that's because if you die, that's it. That's the end. See, that's what your mind tells you. But why do you believe your mind? That's how fear works. All fear is completely illusory. There's nothing to fear in life, including fear of death. And you can discover that for yourself. But the only way you can discover that a fear is an illusion is by actually passing through it. You can't see it while you're on the other side. So, fear, anger, boredom, these three emotions are especially self-deceptive. Especially so. Your mind uses them to manipulate you to avoid doing self-reflection. And they are extremely, extremely effective. Have you noticed that it's very hard to use reason to bust through fear and boredom and anger and depression, for example? It's very hard to reason your way out of fear. If you're afraid of snakes, good luck handling a snake while reassuring yourself through reason that this snake is not going to harm me. If you're afraid of heights, good luck standing on the edge of a tall building all the while telling yourself, oh, this is okay, it's no big deal. Is that going to work? No, of course not. Because this is like your mind's primary way of controlling you. And it is damn sure that you're not going to screw with that just with some simple reasoning. That would be way too easy. That's why mastering emotions is so hard, because they have this charge, this punch to them. When things get really emotional, all philosophy flies out the window for most people. All abstract considerations, all notions of truth, all notions of morality, propriety, of kindness, of love, all that flies out the window as soon as you're angry, as soon as you're fearful, as soon as you're depressed or anything like that. Have you noticed that? Not an accident. That's how your mind controls you. Another self-deception mechanism is not being conscious of your own ego reactions. This is closely related to emotions, but it's a slightly separate thing. Have you noticed that your ego reacts in situations where your self-agenda is threatened? Anytime that there's a significant threat to your self-agenda, your ego reacts with all kinds of emotions. It flares up. It gets agitated. It gets defensive. It gets hostile. Gets angry. Gets offended. Gets upset. Why is this? Well, because your ego's job is to maintain itself and to maintain you as you are and to not allow any kind of change. And this doesn't just pertain to physical threats to your survival. So it's not that if I just put a gun to your head that you're going to get angry and upset and afraid. Of course, that's obviously the case. But it happens in much more subtle ways. For example, you could be an academic scientist. And you could be working on a book. You could be writing a dissertation. You could be doing some very serious physical, scientific, like hard-nosed work. Maybe you're a physicist and you're doing hard physical work. Not physical work, but I mean, you know, physicist work. And then you go to a conference, and at this conference, other physicists are talking. Some other physicist gets up on stage. He starts talking about a theory which conflicts with your theory. And all of a sudden, you notice yourself getting emotional. You're getting heated up. You're getting afraid. You're getting defensive. You're starting to call him names in your mind. You're starting to judge and criticize him. And maybe you even want to stand up and start shouting at this person. How dare you say these things? It's ridiculous. What you're saying is ridiculous. It's unscientific. It's preposterous. It's lunacy. And why do you start to feel that way? Because his model is threatening your model. And you've been working on this model for 5 years. Your entire career is riding on it. You've been writing a book for the last 3 years. What's going to happen to your book if your model gets disproven? But of course, your mind's not going to make any of this apparent to you. The way your mind is going to react is just with name-calling and criticizing and projecting and demonizing. So you're going to demonize that guy up on the stage, even though he might be right, because what your mind really cares about is not the truth, but defending your agenda. And your agenda is to pay the bills, to feed your children, to support your wife or your husband with your career. That's your primary agenda. It's not the truth. You like to tell yourself that you're the scientific person who loves the truth, but that's a big pile of shit. What you really care about is you care about defending your position. And you also care about your intellectual defense of your intellectual positions. So you've bought in as the scientist into this theory, and now you really think the world works according to this theory. So you're not just going to give that up in a sort of cool, rational, objective manner. Not at all. You're going to be very emotional about it. And the deception here is that people aren't conscious of this. People do not generally acknowledge the egoic reactions which influence everything they're doing. And science is especially bad at acknowledging these egoic reactions within science, for example. Science doesn't like to admit the influence of psychology and emotions upon the entire reasoning process, because that sort of admits that the reasoning process is corrupt and that it's not the primary process. Science likes to pretend that emotions and psychology, those are secondary factors, and that really reason is the primary process. No. Reason is actually the secondary process. Psychology and emotions and ego, that's the primary process. But how many scientific books or how many philosophical books talk about ego, talk about psychology, talk about emotions? Very few. Very few. And of course, you should expect that. Because why would the mind talk about these things? The mind hides all these things so that the mind can go about fulfilling its agenda, using science to fulfill its agenda. Science is not about truth. Science is about advancing humanity. First and foremost. Truth, secondarily. Another deception mechanism is projection. This is a huge one. Projection is what you do when there is something within yourself that you don't want to admit to yourself. So what you do is you deny that it's in yourself and you project it out onto others, and therefore you demonize those other people for having that. So for example, people love to project onto terrorists and say, oh, those terrorists, look how evil and selfish they are. But what about you? How evil and selfish are you? See, you don't want to admit it within yourself, so you project it out onto the terrorists. Or you project it out onto the Muslims, or you project it out onto some other group of people, or you project out onto me as the teacher. As a teacher, I've been really amazed to see how much projection happens onto me, because I interact with thousands of people. People write me comments and send me emails, and I read many of them. I've read probably over 10,000 comments and pieces of feedback throughout my entire career so far, and wow, it's amazing because I see people projecting all their own personal problems and issues onto me, because that's what the mind does. The mind tends to kind of work off of its own assumptions and its own issues. So if you're afraid, you're going to project that fear onto me, or if you're angry about something, you're going to project that onto me, or if you're worried about some problem, you're going to project that onto me. Of course, that's a huge self-deception trap. Especially when it comes to learning about spirituality or about personal development, there's going to be a lot of projecting that happens, and you've got to be very careful about being conscious of that, or you will not grow properly. You're not going to learn the lessons. Another mechanism is distraction and red herrings. I actually have shot a whole episode about this. Go check out my episode about distraction. And the subtitle for that episode was actually The Ego's Favorite Defense Mechanism, Distraction. That's right, because distraction is so powerful. All the ego has to do, or the mind has to do, is just to dangle a red herring in front of you, and you're going to go chasing that red herring for 5 or 10 years, ignoring the truth, ignoring self-reflection. It's a very powerful mechanism, and there's just so much to be said about it. Go watch that episode. It's a pretty in-depth episode about distraction. Crusading is another self-deception mechanism. And it also has to do with projection and with distraction. Have you noticed these people who go on crusades? They love to be defenders of things like morality or religion or science or atheism or rationalism or whatever, they're crusading for this. They build a whole career around crusading for some kind of cause. What is this but a self-deception? What is this but a distraction? From doing what? From self-reflecting, from doing inner work. Because when you're crusading against those evil people over there or those deluded people over there, what are you not doing? You're not looking inwards at your own delusions. It's a very sneaky mechanism. How about addiction as a mechanism of self-deception? A huge one. I have a whole episode about addiction. It's called Overcoming Addiction. Go check that one out. It's also a very in-depth episode about all the mechanics of addiction, the real root causes of it, and how addiction is basically just a form of distraction. And there I talk about drug addiction and porn addiction and sex addiction and TV addiction, internet addiction, food addiction, all these addictions. And these are actually the least deceptive of them. The most deceptive addictions are the subtle addictions. And I actually have a separate episode about subtle addictions, which most people don't even realize are addictions. The psychological addictions, which our society holds as just normal. Because see, it's obvious when you're addicted to heroin, it's obvious you're a heroin addict. When you're addicted to alcohol, it's pretty obvious. When you're addicted to porn, it's also sort of obvious. But what's not obvious is when you're addicted to overthinking, when you're addicted to daydreaming, when you're addicted to judging and criticizing, when you're addicted to resenting people for their success, this sort of stuff, very subtle addictions. So check out my episode about that for more on that. Another mechanism is believing that science has figured it all out, or that science will figure everything out if given enough time. This is a huge one I see these days, you know. People just tend to say, oh, well, science will figure it out, or science has figured it out. Well, you know, science is just the best that we can do. So, Leah, what do you expect from me? Science. People just, oh, science. Science is the answer to all these questions, to all these psychological issues. No, it's not. There are certain things that science doesn't cover at all. It's not within the domain of science. See, science is a limited domain thing. It's not all-encompassing. And then the most important aspects of life, science doesn't tackle at all. Like personal development. I mean, it can tackle it. There's certain fields of psychology and cognitive science that do tackle some of these things, but generally not nearly enough that you can actually use that information to actually grow yourself. That's a whole nother level of thing that we're talking about. Another mechanism of deception is having pet theories. Like that scientist I was talking about. Pet theories are a really dangerous thing because we, over time, as we grow, we develop these worldviews, and then we tend to want our worldviews to stay the same. It's actually uncomfortable for the mind to change worldviews. So once I have a theory like evolution, once I have a theory like the Big Bang, once I have a theory about like quantum mechanics or some molecular thing, or I have this thing or whatever, my pet theories, I want them to be that way. You know, I want it to be true. And it seems like it's true, but then contrary evidence can come about with more research that starts to disprove these pet theories. But of course, I like my pet theory more than I care about truth or reality. So I'm going to stick with my pet theory, and I'm going to use various kinds of rationalizations to cling to my pet theory. This becomes a huge sticking point for many people. A huge source of self-deception. And of course, not just scientific people do this, but religious people do this. People in government do this. Have you noticed how ideological politicians get, and they have their pet theories about, oh, raising taxes will do this, or lowering taxes will do this, or gun control will do this, or not controlling guns will do that, or helping out there, you know, starting this war is going to do this. And they don't test any of that scientifically. Those are just all their pet theories, and they just believe in them regardless of any evidence. And then, of course, what they do is they give their own theories special treatment. They criticize all the other theories, but they don't subject their own pet theories to nearly the same level of rigor or critique. And then that leads to self-deception. which brings us to confirmation bias as the next self-deception mechanism. Confirmation bias, cherry-picking evidence, and also narrative making. In general, the way the mind works is that it tends to assume a thing and then build a narrative to fit those assumptions. And then it tends to cherry-pick evidence, the kind that it wants, not the disconfirming kind, but the confirming kind, to bolster this narrative. And this is the classic cognitive bias called confirmation bias. This is a huge, huge thing. I'll talk about it in a dedicated episode. The next mechanism is underestimating paradigms and what I call paradigm blindness. Most people don't appreciate what a paradigm is, and I have a whole episode about understanding how paradigms work. Go check that one out, which goes into great length about the various kinds of paradigms that exist and this phenomenon called paradigm lock or paradigm blindness, where you are stuck inside of a paradigm and you're not able to look at evidence outside the paradigm because you don't recognize that you're stuck inside of a paradigm. This is a big problem for science, a big problem for religion, it's a big problem for all ideologies. The next mechanism is taking basic things for granted. Things like existence, life, matter, energy, space, time, government, money. People take these things for granted. People just assume that, oh, well, these things just are the way reality is. Couldn't be any other way. What is there to know about these things? They don't really question them very deeply. But actually, it's questioning of these very most basic things that leads to some of the most profound insights you could have about reality. And it's within these taken for granted, very fundamental building blocks of reality that the mind deceives you the most, because it can hide so much stuff in these basic elements because it knows that you're not going to question it. You're not going to question time. You're not going to question matter or energy or government or life or existence. You're not going to question any of these things. That's how your mind gets away with so much. Another mechanism is question begging. This is huge, huge. And it's really obvious with religious people when they beg questions. Question begging is just reasoning in a circle. It's posing a question about something, but then answering it and assuming the thing you're trying to actually investigate. But it's also a very big problem for philosophy. It's a very big problem for science. For example, try to get a scientifically minded person to question whether the brain actually is real. They will tend to beg the question in that situation, because you'll say, well, what if the brain isn't real? And they say, well, Leo, how can it not be real? After all, we can cut open your skull and we see some neurons in there. So there's the brain. There we go. Proof that the brain is real. But that's not proof of the brain as being real. That's begging the question. I'm asking you, those neurons you're looking at, as you're looking at them, where are they themselves located? Are the neurons of the brain located in yet another brain? Where are they located? You will say, oh, they're located in a universe. And how do you know there's a universe? Because it's in your brain, because it's in your mind. See, it's completely circular logic. This is just one example of many other examples I could cite of how people beg the question. It's really quite a disgusting and very self-biased way of reasoning. And it's extremely self-deceptive. Basically, your mind is able to get away with murder, with this sort of question begging. You can construct an entire reality from scratch through question begging. The next mechanism is judgment, criticism, and name calling. This is huge. It's not even possible to speak with most people about many of these concepts because they'll immediately judge, criticize, name call, demonize, and completely shut down their mind having this conversation, because most people are addicted to judgment and to criticism. And our society reinforces that with everything you see on the news, with all the political criticism you see around and all the people around you who are so critical. And this leads to the self-deception of closed-mindedness. So many people are so closed-minded to new ideas that That's why I had to talk about radical open-mindedness so much when I was starting actualize.org, because like I knew that the ideas that I wanted to present to you guys were just not going to be accepted if it wasn't pointed out to you how closed-mindedness works, how open-mindedness works, and how important open-mindedness is to actually being able to do an investigation. Because you see, if you're closed-minded to something, that means you can't seriously go and read a book about it or have a conversation about it or invest $1,000 to do a research experiment into it. How are you going to do research if you're already closed-minded to the results of the research? To be an effective researcher and to be really, and for the scientific method to really work, it has to be approached with radical, radical open-mindedness, which most people are not able to do. If you're a scientific person, radical open-mindedness is critical for you. That's how all new discoveries are made within science and mathematics and logic and these sorts of hard fields. It's the most open-minded people who make these discoveries, despite all the closed-minded people that try to convince them that they're wrong. Have you noticed that? That's how the history of science works. And closely related to that is the next self-deception mechanism, which I call New Age bias. This is the aversion that rational and scientific people have towards woo-woo, New Age-seeming ideas or concepts or religious-type stuff. It's like someone starts talking about chakras, and immediately you're like, oh, chakras, oh, why are you talking about this stuff? It's so unscientific. It's so, and then you get so judgmental about it. Oh, it's so New Agey. Oh, that's so wishy-washy. Oh, that's such a hippie thing to say. That's just a particular form of closed-mindedness, which a lot of people have these days, and it really keeps them from advancing and growing to the highest levels of personal development. You can't really get into spirituality unless you're willing to open yourself up to some of these woo-woo, New Age concepts. Because you know what? Some of them are actually true, and some of them are actually really important. They've just been sort of ridiculed so much in popular culture because our popular culture is at a very low level of consciousness. Our popular culture is extremely materialistic and very gross. It doesn't talk about subtle stuff. That's why when you hear subtle concepts, but you're coming from this gross materialistic culture, then it sounds like hippie, New Age, woo stuff. And then you just dismiss it as, oh, it's just nonsense. When in fact, it's not nonsense. You could really benefit from some of those ideas. Now, I'm not saying all of them are true. I'm not saying there's not bullshit in there. There's some bullshit mixed in there as well. But in general, you have to be radically open-minded here if you want to not be self-deceived. So a lot of people deceive themselves because they react against the New Age quality of certain teachings. And another subcomponent of this mechanism is dismissing the occult and mystical and paranormal phenomena. It's almost impossible for me to talk about paranormal phenomena with you guys because I will be immediately criticized for it and labeled a hippie, and I'll be questioned and torn apart with logic and reason and arguments and all the asking for proof, all of this, as if this sort of phenomena is subject to that kind of gross arguing and this sort of armchair philosophy that these so-called skeptics like to do. Doesn't work that way at all. The fact is that there is some validity to the occult and to mystical and paranormal phenomena. Again, I'm not saying all of it is true, but there's some validity there, and it's worthwhile for you to be open-minded to that. Otherwise, you're going to deceive yourself. How about the next mechanism? Blaming, scapegoating, and demonizing. This is very common. You see scapegoating done by societies throughout history. Someone is always blamed for society's problems. It's usually a smaller group of people who can't defend themselves, some minority group. That's how the Nazis did it with the Jews, and it was done back in the in the Greek and Roman times, and of course it's done to this very day. What you're seeing in politics today is a lot of it is just plain scapegoating. And that's because the mind hates to take responsibility for its own problems. It hates to admit itself that it is the cause of all of its suffering. It doesn't like to admit that. So a low conscious mind will deceive itself and project outwards and find a scapegoat. And then it'll blame that scapegoat. It'll demonize that scapegoat. And it will attack that scapegoat. And that becomes a huge distraction from doing what? Turning inwards to investigate, how am I the cause of this? See? And a subcomponent of this is also playing victim. So if you're not scapegoating others and blaming others, then you're victim. You're playing victim yourself. You're thinking of yourself as a victim. It's like, oh, poor me. Why was I born with these bad genetics, with this bad physical appearance, with this low intellect, with this problem here, with that problem there, with such a bad family and this and that. I'm not able to do anything. I'm not able to grow. I'm not able to meditate. I can't focus. I have this problem. I have that problem. And then you're stuck. And this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's extremely self-deceptive once you start to buy into all these victim narratives that you tell yourself. And then your mind will use confirmation bias to cherry pick all the evidence that's around you. It'll discount all the disconfirming evidence. It'll find all the confirming evidence to confirm all of your victim narratives to yourself. The next self-deception mechanism is arguing and debating. This one is a huge distraction. In part one of this series, I talked about the problem with arguing and debating, so I won't cover it much here, but just to point out to you that so many people distract themselves with arguing and debating that it never even occurs to them that they need to be doing work on themselves, introspecting, contemplating, really looking inwards on themselves rather than going out there and debating other people. That's the same problem as crusading. The next mechanism is false skepticism and debunking. A lot of people take on the identity of the skeptic, the cynic, or the debunker. And so what they do is they play the hyper-rationalist, and they go around and they point out all the stuff that hasn't been 100% conclusively proven with double-blind clinical studies. And so they say, oh, chakras, debunked. It's like, oh, vaccinations and autism, whatever, oh, debunked. And this is debunked, and that's debunked. And so they just go around debunking everything. And it's like, acupuncture's been debunked, and meditation's been debunked, and this thing's been debunked, and that thing's been debunked. And they think that by doing this, that they're defending truth. But of course, that's all an exteriorization, a projection. While they're doing that, what are they not doing? They're not debunking their own mind's constructions. They're not self-reflecting. See my episode called True versus False Skepticism. I cover that in a lot of depth there. The next mechanism is human species bias. This is a very profound self-deception trap that almost everybody commits. And especially science is prone to this. Human species bias is basically taking the human perspective of reality as though it were universal and the only one. For example, many scientists believe that mathematics is a universal language. And that if we can communicate with other alien species, let's say there's an alien species on some distant galaxy or star system, we're not going to communicate with it in English. We're going to use mathematics. And supposedly we can send it some mathematical formulas and it'll be able to figure it out because mathematics is universal. There's nothing universal about mathematics. There's nothing universal about science. There's nothing universal about physics. All of this is a human species specific way of understanding reality. It's highly contingent upon our neurochemistry. It's highly contingent upon our cultural assumptions, our metaphysical assumptions. And not only is human understanding not universal, it's not even global. Humans can't even agree with themselves on what reality is and why it is the way that it is and what we should do about it. Even scientists don't agree with each other about everything. So to say that this is universal knowledge, there's no such thing as universal knowledge. This is a complete taking for granted. The only reason that we tend to assume that our knowledge is universal is because we haven't interacted with any other intelligent species in the universe yet. And so, because we have that lack of contrast, we have nothing to contrast our own opinions and models with, we think that we're so great and it's all universal. Well, here's one prediction that I'll make. If we ever discover aliens out there, intelligent aliens in the distant stars, and we make contact with them, what we will be learning from them, and we'll be shocked to learn, is that almost everything we think we know about the universe and nature and reality is highly dependent on our human understanding, our human biology, psychology, and our predispositions. It's not at all going to be what those other intelligent aliens come up with. Their understanding is going to be completely dependent on their brain chemistry, on their culture, and a lot of other factors. And it will be completely different from us. They will have another way of doing science. They'll have another way of doing mathematics. They'll have completely different ways of interacting with reality, like ways you can't even imagine, which are going to be, of course, dependent on their physiology. People don't grasp the significance of this. People also sometimes say, like, oh, Leo, but if everybody in the world just becomes enlightened, all the humans, then we'll have peace on Earth. That's a complete self-deception based on the human species bias. Because notice what you're assuming there. You're assuming that the only thing that really matters is the human species. And that as long as everybody becomes enlightened and every human is peaceful to themselves, that brings peace to the whole Earth. But what about the hundreds of millions of other species that exist on this planet that you're ignoring? Are you taking into account the cockroaches, the ants, the tuna fish, the birds, the elephants? Are you taking all of that into account? How much violence and evil does the human species perpetuate upon all the other species? But see, we don't care about that. We discount that. It doesn't matter to us that when we build a new city, we have to kill perhaps 100 million cockroaches. That doesn't matter to us at all. So even if everyone's going to be enlightened, there's no way you're going to just get peace on Earth. There's no such thing as peace on Earth. Because life is inherently destructive. To have life, you need death. To have life, you need to have evil. You need to have selfishness. And that's something you need to start becoming conscious of. That's not something that's so easily ended. The next mechanism of self-deception is dismissing all of this as mere philosophy. My mom loves to use that one on me all the time. Anytime our conversation gets even a little bit deep about any existential issue, it's always like, oh, Leo, but that's just mere philosophy. What good is that going to do me? It's just philosophy. Is that going to help me feed myself? Is that going to help me improve my job? No, so it's just philosophy. Huge self-deception. Another one is pleading, well, who really knows? Leo, yeah, you're right. We can't be certain about anything. It's all up for grabs. It's all just a wash. We can't know anything. So you're wrong too. Everyone's wrong. Well, everyone could be wrong. And so we don't know what to do. So I'll just go back to watching TV. That's a huge self-deception. This sort of muddying the waters. The mind loves to muddy the water so much that, hey, guess what? I don't have to do anything. I can sit back and watch TV and behave exactly the way that I've always behaved. That's perfect for the mind. That's the perfect self-deception because all the mind wants to do is to maintain homeostasis. How does it do that? By getting you to just do what you've always done. So any reason or justification for the mind to keep doing what it's always been doing is perfect. Because for you to uncover the truth, that's something new. You see, that's new. That requires a change, a radical shift. All the mind has to do is just to prevent any radical shift or change from happening, and it'll guarantee that you'll never discover the inner workings of the mind. and you'll never shatter this illusion that you're in. And the last mechanism that I'll mention here for now is all of your cultural preferences. So when I was talking about indoctrination, the way that happens, one of the ways that indoctrination works is, of course, your culture programs you with all of your preferences, the kind of food you like, the kind of men and women you find sexually attractive, the kind of entertainment that you enjoy, you know, television, books, comedy, the kind of jokes that you'll laugh at, the kind of religion that you prefer. Like, do you prefer Christianity more or Islam more? And you might say, oh, well, Leo, but I'm an atheist. I don't like any religion. Yeah, but which one still? If you had to live around some Christians or some Muslims, which one would you prefer? See, you have those preferences. Of course you do, because your culture imprinted you with those. And it's really hard to get rid of your cultural preferences. A lot of that stuff is literally hardwired into your skull. And it's really difficult to change. Which is why it's difficult oftentimes to teach non-duality to people, because non-duality tends to be very culturally specific. There's all these different traditions and schools of non-duality. Christian ones, Buddhist ones, Taoist ones, Jewish ones, Islamic ones, you know. So many. And yet every one of those cultures has a preference for its own way. So it's really difficult to take a teaching from one culture and then to translate it into another culture. It's oftentimes going to reject it. And then people get very closed-minded about that. And this becomes a huge self-deception because they can't see past their own culture, because your mind will just accept whatever culture was imprinted into it as the best one. No one ever asks themselves, wait a minute, is my culture really the best one? What if it's the worst one? Why do I feel like it's the best one? Could that just be arbitrary that I was just imprinted? If I was like born in Australia, wouldn't I believe Australian culture is the best? Or if I was born in the Middle East, wouldn't I believe Middle Eastern culture is the best? Of course I would. Because that's how the mind works. It just adopts whatever it's fed first. It's really that simple. But people don't get that. They cling to their culture. And it's like, no, we got to preserve our culture. Our culture is so important. I read an article online the other day that the French president in this article, he was extolling the virtues of French culture and the French baguette. And he actually got like some World Heritage Foundation. I don't know the name of the foundation, but some like important world foundation has actually inducted the French baguette, piece of fucking bread, the French baguette, and the recipe for how to make French baguettes into their like cultural archives to preserve that culture. Because we don't ever want it to get lost. Because to the French, the baguette is so important. I mean, it's ridiculous that the French president would even be talking about this. Is ridiculous. You know, of all the things you could be talking about in the universe that, you know, of relative significance, you spend your time talking about a French fucking baguette and how important it is. And of course, I'm not picking on the French here. I mean, every culture does this. American culture does this, and Japanese culture does this, Asian culture. It doesn't matter what culture you are. Because cultures are highly biased. Of course they are. Because cultures are just like collective egos. And of course, a collective ego also exists within every individual. That's how the collective ego is maintained. You are its host, so to speak. It's like the virus inside of you. That's where it lives. You're the medium through which it spreads. So I have only covered about half of the list. I still have about 30 more self-deception mechanisms to talk about, but it's taking me longer than I anticipated. So I think what needs to happen here is I'm going to have to shoot a part three. I didn't want to. I thought I could get it all done in just two parts, but I can see that there's so much more left to talk about, because each one of these takes time to explain. And even here, I'm just breezing through them. I'm barely even scratching the surface of each one of these. So there's going to be a part three coming next week. So stay tuned for that. And this is going to be it here. What I want you to notice as far as these self-deception mechanisms is I want you to start to notice them within yourself. I want you to start to notice them around people who are around you, within your culture. Notice them happening. Notice how sneaky and tricky they are. Notice how difficult it is to change your behavior such that you're not falling into these traps constantly, over and over again. You see, it's not about just avoiding this trap once in your life. Many of these traps happen to you on a daily basis. You have to avoid them every single day, over and over and over again. It's like walking through a minefield, and it's a very long minefield to walk, and it's very tricky, so don't give yourself too much credit. Just because you hear me talking about all this does not make you immune to it. This is like step one of you successfully navigating this minefield is just learning you're inside a minefield. Most people don't even know they're inside a minefield. So yeah, that's a very important fact to learn. But that doesn't solve your problem, does it? Now you need very accurate testing equipment, a mind detector. You need a lot of really good ones that you're going to use to slowly get yourself through this thing. So make sure you stay tuned for next week for more of these maps of where the minds are so you can navigate your way around them. All right, that's it for today. Please click the like button for me right there. Please come check out actualize.org as well. Look at the stuff I have on my website. That's exclusive. I've got the blog with exclusive content and some exclusive videos that I'm posting there. You can't find anywhere else. I've got the forum. Come check out that. Chat with people. Share your ideas. Share your questions. Share your frustrations and confusions. Check out the Life Purpose course. Check out the book list. The book list has a lot of information on it and books that will help you to navigate this minefield. And lastly, just stick around with me for a lot more in-depth coverage of each one of these elements. So there's going to be a part three, but then in the future, you know, in the next year or two, as I'm shooting more content, I will be picking out some of the most important of these self-deception mechanisms, just like I've done in the past, and I'll be shooting dedicated episodes about those, and that's going to be very helpful to you. So make sure you stay tuned for that.